Done, done, and done. He walked over the gravel drive and out to the front yard. The uniformed officers were parked in their patrol car at the curb, coffee containers in hand, car radio on full blast. Officer Brad Jameson was a rookie. His partner, Ray Baxter, was an old-timer. The two of them together didn't have the brain power of a mosquito. This was San Francisco PD's idea of protection.
Officers, he said, I'm taking Sergeant Boxer's advice. Leaving my house and checking into a hotel for a while. My insurance company is paying for it.
Well, that's fine, Mr. Grant. You should let Sergeant Boxer know where you're off to.
Already did it, said Grant.
You need any help with your luggage or anything?
Officer Baxter asked.
No, no thanks.
So where are we going?
Not we. Just little old me. Like I told the sergeant, I won't be needing protection for a couple of weeks. I'll stay at the Marriott while I look for a new place.
Jameson said,
Okie doke. You should also fill out a form at the post office so they hold your mail.
Good idea. So thanks for, thanks.
It was noon when Grant turned out of his driveway and headed toward Bayshore Boulevard. He drove carefully. No mistakes now. No traffic stops. No license checks. No ironic moments. He was on track with his well-wrought plan for a carefully executed and beautiful metamorphosis. Soon he would be in another country, playing an even greater role on an even grander stage. And the memories of all his past roles would continue on inside him. God, he loved his life. Chapter 82. Conklin and I were parked in front of the red brick Hyde Street Psychiatric Center, lunching on egg salad sandwiches.
It was always a long shot, my partner said to me. All we had was a label this big with no trace, no nothing on it.
You know what I hate? I asked him.
Yep, I do. You hate square one and egg salad with pieces of shell.
I hate waiting now for another murder so we can hope for another chance at this.
Look,
Conklin said, pointing past my nose and out the side window. What am I looking at?
That guy. He's a patient. What's he doing outside?
I saw him now. His name was Nettie. He was coming out of an alley that ran between the brick face of the psych center and a blank concrete side of the Walgreens. His hands were in his pockets, eyes down, and his posture and gait were purposeful, entirely different from the awkward movements he'd exhibited just a half hour ago. My partner and I exited the car and began following Nettie from a distance. I wasn't ready to question him until I knew what he was up to. He was directly ahead of us when he took a right turn onto Jones Street. We were so close to him that I was shocked when we turned the corner, and he was just not where I thought he should be. In fact, I didn't see him anywhere. Not in the shade of the smoke shop awning, not buying a paper from the newsstand, not crossing the street. It was as if he'd stepped through a portal into a fourth dimension.
Oh, come on.
Rich, where'd he go?
He wasn't carrying a knapsack, right? Didn't have a bag?
Conklin asked. No, hands in pockets. Nothing on his shoulders or in his hands, I'm sure of it, I said.
Then he'll be back.
My mind was doing flip-flops. Even if we hadn't lost Nettie, what could we charge him with? Leaving the psych center? Maybe he was allowed to go to the post office or whatever. Were we making shit up out of pure desperation? We looked up and down Jones, peering into shop windows, and didn't see Nettie. We split up. I went up Geary, and Richie took O'Farrell. We checked in with each other by phone, and 15 minutes after losing Nettie, Conklin and I met back at the car. We took our seats and kept our eyes on the alley. Damn it to hell! How did we freaking lose that guy? And then, Nettie walked right past us. His eyes were still down, and he was talking to himself. I heard only a few words.
Need some cash.
I said to Conklin, now. We sprang out of the unmarked car and walked up on Nettie as he turned into the alley. We were 10 feet away when he saw us and started to scream. He unlocked the green metal door that led to the building and disappeared inside. I heard the door lock behind him. I pulled on the handle anyway, but it was secure. I let out a few loud curses. Conklin pulled his gun and shot out the lock. Chapter 83. Conklin pulled open the metal door, and we rushed through the doorway into a garbage room piled high with bulging construction bags. The room was about 15 feet square and was bracketed by two doors. We'd come through the first, the metal door that connected the trash room to the alley. Nettie was crouched against the wooden door in the far wall which led to the underground corridor, and he was screaming, "I'm good! I'm good!" At the same time, he was trying to fit a key into the door lock and was having no luck. His height and the short length of his arms and his fear were preventing him from inserting the key. I took very quick stock of the situation. Nettie was crying and wailing, and yet I'd seen him walking normally. If what he was doing now was an act, it was a very convincing act of a man playing with half a deck. My gun was in my hand when I said, "Nettie, give me your keys." He was making terrible whimpering sounds, like a small animal caught in a trap. I wondered what the hell I thought I was doing, holding a gun on a mental patient armed with a set of keys. Did I seriously think I would shoot him? For what? Was this the weird-looking guy who might have killed a half-dozen people or more? Or was he just what he seemed to be, a mental patient on a walkabout? I couldn't know, and I couldn't take any chances. Conklin said,
"Nettie, I'm Richie. No one's going to hurt you, see?"
He showed Nettie his gun, then opened his jacket and slipped the gun into his holster.
"My partner Lindsay will put her gun away, too."
I did it.
Rich went on, "Sorry to scare you, Nettie. Sorry about the noise. Let's go upstairs so we can talk."
Bags rustled behind me. I spun around and saw a maintenance worker hiding between the garbage bags and the wall, his hands over his ears, trying to make himself invisible. Nettie said to Conklin,
"Talk. Just talk, right, Richie?"
Rich reassured him, and Nettie said,
"I give up. I give up."
Nettie was holding a small bunch of keys above his head, and Rich reached for them. Nettie ducked under Rich's arm and threw himself face down on top of the orderly.
"What is this?"
Nettie said to the man,
"Lawrence, we're leaving here together."
Lawrence said,
"Nettie, leave me out of this. Go or don't go. It's no business of mine."
"It is now," said Nettie.
The squeal in his voice was gone. Nettie had a straight-up normal voice, and there was something in his hand. Conklin and I saw it at the same time. It was a syringe, and Nettie had positioned the needle so that it pricked Lawrence's neck. One minute we had been trying to disarm a suspect with a set of keys. Now we had a hostage situation that couldn't be more unstable. This had to be handled with competence and grace, or people were going to die. I used my soothing hostage negotiator tone. "Nettie, tell me what you want so we can keep everyone safe." Nettie angled for a more comfortable position on his bed made of Lawrence's body and the garbage pile. I could see the dimple in Lawrence's neck where the needle penetrated flesh. Blood beaded up on his skin. If Nettie pushed the plunger on the syringe, Lawrence would become paralyzed, and if he couldn't breathe, he would die. We were only a short sprint from the hospital, but as I understood the effect of sucks, we might as well be on Mars.
"Nettie," I said, "tell me what you want."
"I'm working on it," he said. "But while I figure that out, put your guns down on the floor. If you call for help, if you let anyone through either door, my friend Larry is a corpse. I guarantee it."
Chapter 84. I was still stunned by the changes in Nettie. His high-pitched, sing-songy speech was gone. When he fixed his eyes on mine, I saw cool resolve. He was cornered, and he was willing to kill. He might also be willing to die. 10 feet away from where I stood, Lawrence breathed loudly and stretched his neck minutely in an attempt to move it away from the needle. Nettie adjusted his position correspondingly, pressing down on Lawrence with his full weight, sending the needle in deeper. I said, I think I understand what you want, Nettie. No guns, no one comes in, and no one leaves. What's on your mind? He said,
I've killed 8 people. Larry is lined up to be number 9, but here's the thing. I don't like odd numbers. If I kill him, I've got to kill one of you. I admit that would be hard to do, so here's the deal. Take your guns out with your fingertips and kick them over to me. I'll leave and lock the door behind me. Anyone comes after me, I'll shoot. After I'm clear of this shithole, you'll never see me again.
We can't do that, I said. It's got to be our way. Put down the needle, Nettie. Live to see another day.
Oh, lady cop, do you really think I'll just give up and let you put me away? I've been locked up for my whole life. Isn't that enough?
We were in a freaking standoff from hell. Adrenaline had redlined my heart rate. I was fully aware that Nettie could pump Larry full of sucks before I got my gun out of my holster. I said in the calmest tone I could muster, I hear you, Nettie, and here's my counteroffer. Let Larry go. My partner and I will work with the DA and tell your side of the story, the abuse you've suffered, the extenuating circumstances that brought you to this point. He'll listen to us. Nettie remained in a crouch only yards in front of me. It wasn't going well for Larry. He whimpered and said,
Nettie, man, I never did anything to you.
Nettie said, Shut up, Larry.
It looked to me that he was weighing his options. I was weighing mine. Could I dive onto him? Knock the needle out of his hand? I was gauging the distance when Nettie spoke.
If I give up, he said, you have to tell the media in your own words. Make sure they understand that I'm a genius who fooled everyone. You have to make it clear that in your professional opinion, Edward Lamborghini is one of the most brilliant serial killers of this century. Do that. Give me your word.
I didn't trust him, but I needed him to trust me. I said, Okay, Nettie. That's a deal I can live with. You have my word. Now slowly toss the needle down. A dreamy smile came over his face. What was this psycho thinking? He locked his eyes on mine. And,
no, he pushed the plunger. At the same time, I heard the shot. Conklin!
Nettie shouted and the needle jumped out of his hand. He gagged, rolled off Lawrence and the mound of garbage bags and lay still. Conklin went to Lawrence, who clasped the side of his neck and gasped,
He stabbed me.
I grabbed the keys off the floor and jammed one after the other into the lock in the basement door. On the third try, the key twisted easily and the door creaked open. I ran into the cavernous and well-traveled basement corridor. I saw a medical team conveying a patient on a stretcher towards St. Vartan's. I flashed my badge and I yelled, We need help! 2 men are down! 1 needs a respirator! Now! We need an emergency unit! Now!
Chapter 85. Nettie hadn't moved since he was shot, but Lawrence Janes was gasping the shallowest of breaths.
I held his hand. I was thinking that the sucks was old. There was a chance Nettie hadn't shot the full dose into Larry before he went down. If sucks was injected into a muscle rather than an artery, it took longer for the drug to paralyze the body. That was good for Larry. I fanned a small flame of hope and stayed with him, telling him, It's going to be okay. You're going to be fine. I'm here. We're getting help. Hang in there, Larry. Hang in there. An emergency team blew through the doorway. He was injected with sucks, I said. The medic didn't ask any questions, just went straight to work and bagged Larry right there on the floor. Seeing his chest rise and fall gave me such relief that tears came into my eyes. Another doctor attended to Nettie. He listened to his heart and announced, He's gone. With his body limp, spread out on the pile of garbage bags, Nettie looked deceptively young and innocent, and good. I took Richie's gun and I called Brady. It was a good shot, Brady, I said. Conklin had no choice.
I'm on the way, said Brady.
I told the medical personnel to leave Nettie's body just as it was.
that the police were coming, that everything in this room was ours until further notice. I opened the alley door and stood in the doorway with Richie, looking out at the blank concrete wall. I said to my partner, Nettie had no way out and so he chose suicide by you, Rich. He said he didn't want to spend another day in lockup. He knew we were armed. He wanted to go out on murder victim number 9. You saved Larry's life and he's going to have a great story to tell his grandchildren. You did what you had to do, and you did it perfectly. He nodded. He said,
Thanks.
But he was hurting. And then he said,
You know what I hate?
I do. He hates to shoot someone. He hated that he'd taken a life. I told my partner that I'd be back in a second, then wandered out into the alley out of earshot from Rich and called Cindy. I've got something for you, I said. The stealth killer is dead, and yes, that's on the record. Give me a couple of hours, I'll get Brady to give it to you officially and with quotes.
That would be tremendous, Lindsay.
Right now, though, can you call Richie? I think he really needs to talk to you. Chapter 86. Cindy was in her office at the San Francisco Chronicle polishing her story headlined, The Stealth Killer's Last Stand. Lindsay had told her about the shooting death of Edward Lamborghini, a.k.a. Nettie Lambo, by an unnamed homicide inspector, and how close the victim had come to taking the life of hospital employee Lawrence Janes. Lindsay had also put Brady on the phone to confirm her story, after which Cindy had spoken with Dr. Terry Hoover, director of the Hyde Street Psychiatric Center. According to Dr. Hoover, Nettie had had privileges. Chief among them was that he had permission to leave the facility alone during daylight hours as long as he returned by dinnertime curfew. The dazed Dr. Hoover allowed that Nettie had been well-liked, a friend to all, and that it seemed to him in retrospect that this patient had been wildly underestimated.
It's possible, I suppose, said Hoover, that Edward could have had access to drugs here at the psychiatric facility, to the pharmacy at St. Vartan's, and to the whole of San Francisco. But did he commit any crimes? The Nettie Lambo I knew could never have done that.
But he had. After speaking with Hoover, Cindy had researched Edward Lamborghini's background, and while she couldn't unseal his criminal record, she thought he had to have committed a horrific crime to be sent to Johnston Youth Correctional when he was only 7 years old. When Johnston had closed, Nettie was transferred to the Hyde Street Psychiatric Center, a next-to-zero security hospital. She thought the facility would be tightening up their privileges policy. PDQ. Cindy scrolled to the top of her page. Under the headline was her lead paragraph. Edward Lamborghini, a patient at the Hyde Street Psychiatric Center on Brush Street at Hyde, was shot to death today by a homicide inspector of the SFPD. Sergeant Lindsay Boxer, who was present at the scene during the incident, said, Mr. Lamborghini confessed to killing 8 people. He was armed and holding a bystander hostage. He refused to drop his weapon and attempted to kill his hostage with a lethal injection before he was brought down. Lindsay's quote was perfect. Richie hadn't been able to speak to her on the record about his takedown of Nettie Lambo, but he'd given her background color that had made the writing pop. Descriptions of the signage in the trash room, the smell of garbage, the look of the cavernous underground tunnel. The story was good, vivid, accurate, moving. Cindy reread the entire 4,000-word piece again, tightened it up in a few places, spell-checked everything. Then she sent her story to the editor-in-chief, Henry Tyler. While she waited for him to read it, she called Richie. When she left him that morning, he'd been in deep sleep getting the rest he deserved and needed.
I'm doing good, babe,
he said to her.
I'm having chocolate chip ice cream and coffee with heavy cream. You only live once, right?
Totally right.
And now I think I'll go back to bed.
Cindy smiled, just picturing him.
See you later. I love you, she said.
I love you too, Sin.
Tyler buzzed her. She punched a button on her console.
Henry?
Great job, Cindy. Fire away. Let's meet after lunch and discuss your follow-up on this.
Cindy sent her stealth killer to the copy editor and sat back to enjoy the moment. Tyler loved the piece, and people who had been afraid of the stealth killer would now feel safer out on the street. Cindy tidied her desk, then went to the cafeteria for a late breakfast. When she returned to her desk and opened her mail, she saw that her inbox was overflowing. The emails all voiced variations on the theme, "What great news! Thank God it's over." Almost buried in that avalanche of email was one from Lindsay reminding the members of the Women's Murder Club that they had a meeting tonight. Not for laughs over a spicy meal, but a working get-together at the Hall of Justice Homicide Squad Room. Lindsay was hoping that if they pooled their resources and gave the Connor Grant files a thorough thrashing, they might come up with something damning enough to counter his unjustified, vengeful, and just plain evil complaint against Lindsay. If it was possible, Cindy was sure that the four of them could do it. Chapter 87. I had commandeered the break room for our meeting because it had a long, well-used table and four folding chairs. There was also a coffee maker close at hand, and a big tin of oatmeal cookies on the counter, courtesy of Inspector Samuels. I'd asked the property room to bring up the dozens of boxes we'd taken from Connor Grant's garage laboratory before his trial. He had never asked for their return. They were stacked now in a line against a wall, 12 across, 8 high. Conklin and I had gone through about half of the boxes before the trial and marked the ones we'd ransacked with an X. Nothing we'd found rose to the level of evidence against the science teacher. No. The boxes were neatly filled with papers related to classwork, but no material on bombs, mass murder, GAR, or any anti-government activity like we'd hoped to find. We'd given up after the 50th box, owing to the press of work and shortage of manpower. Tonight, the WMC was going to dig through the rest. "Why bother with this?" I asked the girls rhetorically. "Because his complaint to IAB calls me a liar and could cost me my job and my career. Also, and probably more importantly, I think the guy is guilty. He told me that he bombed Citron. Why?"
"My theory," said Claire, "is that he's like an arsonist. He was elated at having pulled off the explosion. He was high. So he bragged to you, and then reality set in when he was booked."
Yuki said,
"Or he wanted to up the stakes, blow up Citron and also beat the justice system."
I said, "I like both theories. Connor Grant is the human equivalent of a switchblade. He acted as his own brilliant lawyer, and he got off. In my opinion, that just does not comport with the personality of a career high school science teacher. Yuki, you agree?"
"In spades. He was smooth and tricky and sympathetic at the same time. Hey, he beat our pants off."
I said, "I keep asking myself, who is this masked man anyway? Granted, going through his boxes could be yet another dive into ninth grade science, but if there's a clue in here..."
"We'll know it if we see it," said Cindy.
"Exactly," I said. "I'm hoping for dirty pictures, sketchy bank accounts, warrants for previous misdeeds, and, of course, his plans for blowing up a big public venue. Or, hey, Mr. Grant, surprise us. It would be a genuine bonus round if we found evidence of a crime that he was never charged with. But for tonight, as a minimum, I'd just like to find something ugly that will scare this guy and get him to retract his complaint against me." We did a four-way fist bump and divvied up the boxes. Claire likes to work with music. She fired up her smartphone and tuned into something classical. Then she grabbed a file box, lifted out a fat sheaf of paper, and set it down on the table in front of her. Yuki and Cindy worked as a team, each sorting through a box at a time, showing various bits of paper to each other as they went. I watched everyone and worked on my own box as well. I was scraping the bottom of my third box when a name that I had seen before jumped out at me. I shouted, "Yuki, there's a paper here on litigation written by a Samuel Marks, University of Miami. I found law books in Grant's place with bookplates saying they belonged to Sam Marks." Yuki said,
"Looking up Samuel Marks now."
She tapped on her laptop, then said,
"He was a lawyer in Skokie, died about 10 years ago in a house fire."
I said, "If you type Sam Marks plus Connor Grant, what do you get?" She shook her head. "Nothing." Had Grant known Marx? Had he bought Marx's books at a tag sale? It was a connection between Grant and the law, but it added up to nothing. Yet. Chapter 88. We worked from 6 until 10 when Claire said, "Let's air out our brains, okay?" She queued up one of her husband Edmund's orchestra pieces, the double bass concerto in D major by von Hall. The music absolutely lightened our moods. Coffee cups were topped up and we polished off the tin of oatmeal cookies, including the crumbs. Cindy, Claire, and Yuki texted their significant others, and I called Mrs. Rose, telling her that I'd be home in a couple of hours. I hope so, anyway. But unopened boxes were calling. After the break, we began sifting and sorting again. Mainly, we had found photocopies of newspaper clippings about explosions, randomly interspersed between tests on astronomy, paleontology, and basic chemistry, papers we'd set aside for further discussion. When all boxes had been searched, we talked back and forth about our findings. For instance, I had something in my hand that was pretty shocking. It was a copy of a Wisconsin newspaper article about a house fire 30 years ago in which a family had died. According to the story, a backyard grass fire had lit up a propane tank, destroying a suburban home, flattening it to rubble. 4 people had lived in that house, and they were so burned up the bodies couldn't be identified. It seemed significant, so I opened it up to the floor. Is this the beginning of Connor Grant's story? Did this gas explosion get him thinking about the power and the glory of bombs? Why else would he save it? Claire said, "He may have known the family." She Googled the name of the town and Connor Grant's name, then said, "I got Zippo." We took a few more spins around the internet, and the search for Connor Grant science teacher produced small-time science fair pieces on Grant going back a dozen years.
"They could be real stories, or they could be planted," Cindy said. "It's not too hard to post something about yourself in a chat room or on a blog, start a website, write an article for a small-town paper. Then it gets picked up by other publications, not fact-checked, and then it shows up multiple times on Google."
"Listen to this," Claire said. She read from the article. "William Tilly officiated at a memorial service for his friend Connor Grant, a climate scientist who was killed in a plane crash." Claire looked up. She said, "This Connor Grant's body was never recovered from the burned wreckage."
"Is there a picture?" Cindy asked.
There was. But the dead in a plane crash scientist Connor Grant didn't look anything like our Connor Grant. I stared at the photo of the chief mourner, William Tilly. He wasn't Connor Grant's twin, but I thought he looked more like our Connor Grant than the dead man. I Googled Tilly's name and 4,000 William, Willie, Bill, Billy Tillys popped up. So where were we? We had a collection of articles citing the violent, fiery deaths of several people who didn't actually link up. What did these people mean to Connor Grant? Why did he collect stories of this type of tragedy? Were they his victims? We weren't going to be able to chase down all these deaths tonight. After 6 hours of dedicated hard work, we'd crossed off every last box, found semi-intriguing tidbits that added up to not much of anything, and certainly not a dirty bomb to drop on my enemy. "Thanks for the really good try," I said. The girls said that they were sorry, and we hugged all around before cleaning up and leaving for home. I thought about Grant on the drive back to Lake Street. Had we been looking for something that didn't exist? Was Connor Grant exactly who he said he was? A high school teacher with a deep and far-reaching mind? If so, why did I persist in feeling that he had scammed all of us by getting away with mass murder? Was Grant a mystery that would never be solved? He still had me in the stocks with his IAB complaint, but as for what I had on him, I still didn't have even a clue. Chapter 89. The man who was spending his last 24 hours as Connor Grant counted out his cash. He had $45 in fives, 8 singles, and some loose change. He wanted to use all of it before he got on the plane. He had been staying inside his suite at the middle-of-the-road businessman's Traveler's Inn for the last 2 days. No one knew where he was, not his lawyer, not the cops, not the school. He had wanted this little cushion of alone time in order to rest up before his big farewell to the city by the bay. He had spent the time well, lying in the middle of the big bed, listening to his playlist of favorites on his iPhone. Room service on demand. Memories on demand, too. He took his time and reviewed the 5 years he'd spent in San Francisco. He thought about the kids in his classes at St. Brendan, and by count he remembered every one of them. He remembered meals with ocean views, cable car and ferry rides, books he'd read by the fire in his little house. He thought of women he had slept with and their stories, and he didn't skip over the conversations or the goodbyes. He sipped his scotch and played his music, unspooled the images in his mind. He wanted to save the best for last, and then it was there. He remembered building the compression bomb with a fire extinguisher, filling it with gas, adding the perchlorate, leaving the bomb under the skirts of the space travel exhibit, which was a few yards from the spiral staircase that went up to the dome. He remembered packing the fistful of C4 with a timer into the cyborg exhibit at the front of the welcome gallery, so that the doors would blow 25 minutes after the big compression bomb detonated. And he thought about that girl he'd paid for a couple of hours earlier that day. Irish, he thought. Reserved. Modest, even. She'd needed the money, and he had needed her. Win-win. While the sunset came on outside his windows, Grant let the rest of that evening play unedited through his mind. He remembered with crystal clarity that he had been standing on the Embarcadero not far from Pier 15 as the timer set off the compression bomb. The size and scope of the blast had been beyond his expectations. The shower of glass seemed to turn the air to ice, freeze it so that it reflected the light and the roaring magnificence as the building fell to its knees. Images overlapped, the destruction still unfurling, overlaid with the screaming of fire engines and of the crowds, so many people. That explosion was one of the pinnacles of his life. The 2 months in jail had passed quickly as he prepared for the trial. He had relished the planning of it, and it had exceeded his dreams in the execution. It had been so easy and even hilarious to watch the faces of the prosecution as he turned the jury into his best friends. Too bad he wouldn't be here for Lindsay Boxer to get the boot from the SFPD. The humiliation would devastate her, but for him, the complaint had just been a distraction while he planned his next move. Grant finished his scotch and looked at the room service menu. He ordered, and while he waited, there was one thing he wanted to do before checking out tomorrow. He wanted to thank his friend Dylan Mitchell, the great Hate himself. He picked up his burner phone and composed an email. Hate, I'm leaving on a jet plane. Thank you for your guidance, inspiration, encouragement. Couldn't have made glass rain under a setting sun without you. Grant. He sent the message, and it was answered immediately. Grant, you've left your mark on the movement. I am glad to have helped you birth your vision. Thanks for the gift of your notebook. Burn your phone. A.N. A.N. Apocalypse Now. Grant sighed happily. No more souvenirs. He took the chip out of the phone and flushed it down the toilet. Then he opened the door all the way for the room service waiter and his double cheeseburger. Chapter 90. I was working late at my desk, moments from shutting off the computer, when Jacoby appeared in front of me.
Glad I caught you.
Only good news, please, Jacoby.
Task force needs you.
No, they don't. I'm wiped. I'm done. Jacoby continued talking as if he hadn't heard me, and I was quite sure there was nothing wrong with his hearing.
Do you know of a Dylan Mitchell? Goes by the name of Hate?
Hate, I said. What's that, some kind of tag? Jacoby said,
H-A-I-G-H-T, like the street.
I shut down my computer. Drank down the dregs of my coffee, threw the container into the trash. Don't think so. What about him? I asked.
He's a big player in the terrorist underground. He grew up on the flower power down with the government revolution, and has turned into a cheerleader for the new suicide bomb generation.
I'm not sure I'm following. Jacoby laughed.
My fault. See if you follow this. This guy Haight is a pot stirrer. He disseminates videos on the so-called inevitable breakdown of the system. His motto is power to the people by any means, especially violent means. He's shrewd, has a quick delivery. But we know where this leads. Bloody hell. Problem is he just informs and rants, but doesn't dictate or advise, so technically what he's doing is not illegal.
I'm waiting for the punchline.
Patience, Boxer. I'm briefing you on your assignment.
If I choose to accept it. He ignored me.
DHS went through Jay's computer, which he attempted to scrub and left behind in that tenement in the Tenderloin. Also, DHS went through Yang's computer, Ingleside. They found a connection between those two and Haight.
Now I was interested. Very. Said Jacoby.
Jay's computer and Yang's have something in common, what the gearheads call hash code, like a fingerprint, showing contact with Haight's computer which the feds have been hacking forever.
But is it a crime that these three were in contact? Cops all around me were leaving for home. I said goodnight to Chi, waved at Cappy. Samuels said,
Do you need help here, Boxer?
I'm okay. Jacoby sat on the corner of my desk.
Boxer.
I'm listening.
Good, because this is where I get to the point. This really is going somewhere. Haight is in the spotlight because two known terrorists contacted him. Now DHS just got a hit on Haight's computer. Connor Grant emailed Haight, and he wrote back.
Really?
Really,
said Jacoby.
This is the key fact. Grant thanked Haight for his support, guessing that the support was for Grant's attack on Citron. Grant says to Haight that he's leaving town. Didn't say when, and we don't know where Grant is, but DHS wants to pick up Mr. Flower Power and question him. He could be a co-conspirator in a terrorist act that killed 25 citizens of our city.
I was stunned. I'd just about given up on Grant, and now it sounded like he had finally left a virtual fingerprint on the Citron disaster and had implicated an even bigger catch.
SWAT is out front waiting for you. Conklin is on the way. I wish I could go,
said Jacoby.
Now get out of here.
Chapter 91. Haight was in his studio watching the sky go cobalt blue beyond the reinforced glass. After his brief exchange with Connor Grant, creator of the Citron bomb, Haight changed his IP address. It had been a mistake to write to Grant, the first time he'd ever written back, but he had to say goodbye to his prize pupil. He'd always enjoyed Grant's clear-headed intelligence, his scientific mind. He finished cleaning up his hard drive and he planned his evening. He was baking root vegetables and while they cooked, he would post a podcast. Some audacious lone wolf bombings had taken place this week in New York and several cities in Europe. It was very important that he cheer on the loyal soldiers everywhere. It was important to send out a message to motivate others. He was making his notes, gathering his thoughts for his podcast, when he saw a line of cars coming down 20th Street toward his factory.
Oh, shit.
Haight heard the chopper blades as cars filled the parking area below. He ran upstairs to the roof and put up his hands, yelling ineffectually,
Don't shoot!
God damn it.
Of course he'd been hacked. No surprise, but one little mistake, 122 characters immediately deleted and cleaned to death. And still the fucking net had closed.
Don't shoot!
Chapter 92. I was riding shotgun in the lead car with Tactical Force Commander William Niles as we bumped over the broken asphalt in the industrial section of Dogpatch. Choppers were lending air support, and Niles was on the radio instructing his team. As bright lights from the helicopters lit up an old factory, our assault vehicles pulled into a line, blocking the roadway and providing cover. A man was standing on the roof of his factory home with his hands up, but when the blinding lights hit him, he ran back into the building. Niles was out of the car and on the bullhorn.
Come out, Mr. Mitchell. You're surrounded.
Conklin and I got out of the vehicle. What was Haight going to do? On Niles's go, the TAC team ran forward and took positions on all exits, and two men rammed in the front door. Flashbangs lit up the windows, and a moment later the spear tip of our counterterrorism task force went in. I found a stunned Dylan Mitchell, a.k.a. Haight, sprawled out on his bed, barely conscious. Niles filled a pot with water and splashed it on the man who was stirring up crazy anarchists in America and the rest of the world, then yanked him awake and into a sitting position.
What?
The man asked.
We're arresting you for conspiracy and recent bombings and other acts of terrorism. I have federal warrants to search your premises and to confiscate your electronic devices, including your phone and your computer. Your ass belongs to the DHS until further notice.
I haven't done anything. I posted a blog.
Okay, well, we say you conspired with Connor Grant in the bombing of Cytron and are implicated in the deaths of 25 people. That's for starters.
I don't know any Connor Grant, and that's the truth.
Conklin was looking at something that was all but hidden under the bed on wheels. He reached under and with a gloved hand pulled out a fat notebook that looked to be handwritten and dog-eared. I knew what it was. In fact, Conklin had found this notebook, or one just like it, in Grant's garage laboratory. He read the title out loud.
How to Make a Bomb. For $25 in 25 minutes by Connor A. Grant. Bedtime reading, Mr. Mitchell?
Looked like Haight swallowed the ordinary and stupid protest, I don't know what that is or how it got there, but he wore the hangdog expression of defeat. A man in black relieved Conklin of the notebook and bagged it. Niles turned to me.
Sergeant Boxer, will you do the honors?
Conklin was right there with me when I spoke to the man sitting on his bed. Dylan Mitchell. He looked into my face and broke out into a smile.
Oh my God,
he said.
I lived long enough to actually see lipstick on a pig.
I said, I'll take that as a yes. Conklin walked behind him and cuffed him tightly. Mr. Mitchell, you have the right to remain silent, understand? I read him every one of his rights and stepped aside as he was dragged to his feet and out the door to an assault vehicle. He was yelling now.
You never get away with this! I guarantee it!
Tell it to your lawyer, I shouted back.
I've had a long day.
Chapter 93. I slept well that night, and the next day was shaping up beautifully. Haight, guru to the kill, torture, and explode movement, a man who had reinvented Haight speech and who hid behind the name Gar, had spent the night in federal custody. One could only hope and pray that taking him out of circulation, eliminating the incendiary posts he sent out to the four corners of the planet, would have some slowing effect on homegrown terror everywhere. In other news, there was a letter on my desk when I got to work that morning. Conklin said, grinning sheepishly,
I read it. I couldn't help myself. I'm a detective, you know.
I said, all right, all right. I love you anyway, you snoop. The letter was from Lieutenant William Hoyt, IAB, formally dismissing the complaint against me on the grounds that there was no reason for further investigation. Hoyt wrote, you did your job by the book and went above and beyond. We're lucky to have an officer like you on the force. Parisi stopped by with cupcakes and gave me a hug. When Parisi hugged me, I knew I'd been thoroughly hugged. I called Joe from work and said, how about dinner at our place? It was a big step, and I thought I was ready for it. I left work at 6 without anyone throwing spike strips in front of me and got home without incident. I didn't have much time, but I dressed for the occasion, wearing tight, distressed jeans and a loose white shirt, and let my hair down the way Joe likes it. I topped off my act with aqua blue toenails, which I showed off by going barefoot. Joe rang the doorbell at 7 on the dot and was greeted by everyone. Julie, best dog, and me. And wouldn't you know, even on short notice, he brought imported sauce from a small town in northern Italy, dessert from B Patisserie, and a bottle of Brunello, a varietal from Tuscany, which he'd bought at the liquor store down the street. I'm pretty sure that bottle cost an extravagant $100. Joe looked like the Joe I loved and had known in so many ways. Lover, husband, companion, father of my child, and secret keeper who'd sworn to make things right. His dark curls had grown out, so I asked to see his scars so that I could put my hands in his hair. And then I was in his arms. He kissed me, and it felt like the first time years ago when we'd worked a case together, him with the FBI, me a lieutenant with the SFPD, and there had come a moment when we both just knew. This, the two of us, it was going to happen. Joe said,
I knew Grant's complaint was going nowhere.
I didn't, but I couldn't make a plan B. I didn't want a plan B.
I'm really happy with plan A.
Me too. He kissed me again, and I almost forgot the pasta on the stove and a darling little girl who looked like her dad who was underfoot. And so was Martha. We stole another kiss, and the promise was made without words. There would be more. Joe stirred his special red sauce, and I made the salad with radicchio and romaine, escarole, and ripe Campari tomatoes. I whipped up a balsamic vinaigrette, spiced per Joe's own recipe. And as we cooked, we talked about bringing down hate, of course. And we talked about Julie, how bright she was, how talkative, how she wanted a bed without fences, and we laughed at that. Soon she would be going to kindergarten, but not yet. There was plenty of time before Julie went to school. Family time. I set the table and Joe brought Julie over to her chair. I was trying on the thought of asking Joe to stay the night. It was up to me. It might be better to let dinner go with kisses and hugs and have another date next week. But I knew, and he knew, that I missed him. Julie missed him. So much time had passed and so much had happened since we'd split up. It was crazy to obsess about the past, right? Joe was dishing up dinner for Julie and me when my phone buzzed, rattling the glass top of the coffee table far away in the living room. Joe said,
Don't take it, Linz.
Then the landline rang. I'd better, I said. I'll make it quick. I answered the wall phone in the kitchen where I could watch Joe cutting up spaghetti for Julie. Right now? I said to Jacoby. Okay. I switched on the living room TV and called my husband over. Joe? Look! He stood up, came over, and focused on what I couldn't believe I was seeing. A retina-searing blast had lit up the television screen. The newsman was saying that this explosion had happened in front of City Hall. I pressed the phone to my ear. Oh, my God. Warren, please tell me again what he said. He talked and talked. And I listened, even though I kept saying, Oh my God. Oh my God. Chapter 94. Connor Grant double-checked the room for anything left behind, placed $15 on the dresser for the housekeeper. He strapped his big duffel onto the trolley, hung his travel bag over his shoulder, and headed down to the front desk. Connor Grant's credit card was currently in good standing, and after the charges that would never be paid were rung up, he rolled his duffel bag through the doors and out to the front of the motel. A cab was waiting. The driver was a woman built like a jockey. She wanted to help him with his bag, but he said, No, no. Please, just open the trunk. I'll handle this. He got into the cab, telling the driver, Two stops, please. First, City Hall. And then SFO International Departure. The driver said, Okay, boss, and flipped the meter. The man wearing the blue cap leaned back and enjoyed the ride. His plans were vivid in his mind. He wanted his goodbye kiss to be incendiary and unforgettable. City Hall was an architectural masterpiece. Inaccessible, of course, but he had scoped out a vulnerable spot. There was a short ramp off McAllister Street that led to a valet parking area just below street level. There would be no valet there at night, and as he saw it, he could simply leave the duffel with the timer set for when he was high above the clouds. The driver's name was Minnie. She was a careful driver, and he liked that. She didn't speed, wasn't aggressive, and even used turn signals. They drove along McAllister, lit up and with a modest amount of traffic. Passing the intersection at Polk, they approached City Hall, and Grant leaned forward and spoke to the driver.
Just pull in over there.
Valet parking, you mean?
Minnie asked.
I can't. That's not allowed. It's okay. Completely okay, Grant said. We're only stopping for half a minute.
She looked into the rearview mirror, caught his eyes. He smiled encouragingly. She put on her directional signal, crossed McAllister, and stopped at the top of the short ramp.
Okay, this is good,
Grant said. He could walk his duffel down to the entrance.
Just open the trunk latch for me.
Why?
She asked.
We're still going to the airport, aren't we?
Yes, I'm just getting something out of the trunk.
No, sir. I can't do that. Please understand, I've had people run off without paying the fare. You owe me $13.50.
Open the damned latch, he said,
barely keeping his anger in check.
I'm not bolting on the fare.
He got out of the cab and walked toward the trunk. Then he saw her hand out.
God damn it.
His wallet was in his travel case inside the car. $13. Swearing, he opened the rear door again. Chapter 95. Master Sergeant Kerry Woodhouse was part of a 3-man vigilante team made up of his father, Micah, his brother, Jeff, and himself. When Connor Grant had put the jury under a spell and gotten away with 25 counts of murder, including that of Carrie's dear wife, Lisa, he'd stood tall in the courtroom and promised Grant that he would pay for what he'd done. Those weren't just words. It wasn't a casual promise. Jeff had been watching Grant's house when that sicko pulled out of his driveway on Jamestown Avenue and took Route 101 to the Traveler's Inn on Lombard Street. Jeff had waited for Micah to take the next shift, and Carrie had called the motel, asked to speak to Mr. Grant. What was his room number again? He had sweet-talked the operator, said he only wanted the room number so he could send a priority letter. That he'd tried, but the courier service would not accept the front desk as an address. The operator had caved.
Don't tell anyone, she said.
I promise,
Woodhouse said, and hung up his phone. After that, the three Woodhouse men took 8-hour shifts watching Grant's window from where they'd parked across the street on Lombard, in front of the Gala restaurant and lounge. They knew when he was sleeping. They knew when he was awake. And Carrie was on watch when Grant left the Traveler's Inn carrying 2 bags. One hung by a strap over his shoulder. The other was a large duffel bag which he loaded into the cab's trunk himself. Carrie Woodhouse pulled into traffic and stayed 4 cars back from Grant's cab. When it headed into town toward the Civic Center, 5x6 blocks of majestic old granite buildings surrounding a treed plaza, Woodhouse felt some alarm. City Hall was the focal point of the Civic Center, with its huge gilded dome, which was taller than even the dome topping the Capitol building in D.C. The Civic Center plaza was always open. It was a public square, but why would Grant be coming here at night? Carrie Woodhouse continued following the cab along McAllister, crossing Polk. The cab reduced speed and signaled for a left turn. It looked like the taxi was taking the short ramp in front of City Hall that led down to a valet parking area below. Then the cab stopped at the top of the ramp. Woodhouse pulled his car into the fire lane, out of the way of sparse traffic, and watched Grant's cab from 50 feet away. He called Micah and Jeff, told them what he'd seen, and that he was pretty sure what was on Connor Grant's program for the night. What Grant had done to Citron had described his character in full, and a man's character didn't change. Woodhouse felt strongly that Grant was looking for another high-value target. The valet parking area was as close as a vehicle could get to the north entrance of City Hall, a beautiful and historic building, the jewel in San Francisco's crown. The cab was still poised at the top of the ramp, not moving. He tried to anticipate Grant's next move. As he watched, the cab's left side rear passenger door opened and Grant got out. He leaned down toward the driver's window, seeming to be demanding that the cab driver open the trunk. It also seemed to Woodhouse that the driver was refusing. He had his hand sticking out the window, the universal sign for give me the money. Woodhouse took it that the driver wanted to be paid and that he wasn't taking the cab any farther. Maybe he'd gotten a whiff of nutcase stink off his passenger. Woodhouse, a former military officer, didn't need to wait for this dispute to be settled. He opened his car door and placed his Ruger 10/22 rifle on the doorframe. He took a bead on Grant's temple and said softly,
"This is for you, Lisa."
He fired. A split second before Woodhouse's gun went off, Grant reached into the back seat of the cab. The crack of the rifle shot was loud enough to shock both Grant and the cab driver. The driver leapt from the cab and ran. It was a woman, skinny, fast, and she just vamoosed.
Good, thought Woodhouse. One less thing to worry about.
Then he noticed that Grant had taken a position behind the cab's rear passenger door. Grant fired his pistol at Woodhouse. He got off three quick shots. The first one hit Woodhouse in the shoulder, and the other two went through his windshield. Woodhouse fired back, but the pain and the bleeding from his shoulder threw off his aim. Instead of blowing a hole through Grant's head, his shot hit the trunk of the cab. The last thing Carrie Woodhouse expected to happen under that black, starry sky was for something loud and as bright as the sun to obliterate everything. Chapter 96. I hung up with Jacoby and tried to tell Joe what I could barely understand or believe. The TV was on mute and the explosion was on a short loop. It kept playing again and again, with a crawl at the bottom of the screen reading, "Bomb goes off at Civic Center. Area is closed while bomb squad, fire department, police contain the perimeter." Joe said,
"What did Jacoby say?"
I said, "It was about Connor Grant. Jacoby told me that Grant was trying to blow up City Hall."
"How does he know that?"
Joe asked me to repeat every word of what Jacoby had told me. We were in the living room, out of Julie's earshot. I told Joe, "A man called the police station right after the explosion and asked for the chief. His name was Micah Woodhouse. He was the father-in-law of Lisa Woodhouse, one of the Cytron victims. Micah told Jacoby that his son Carrie had been watching Grant, making sure that he didn't blow up anything again. According to Micah Woodhouse, Carrie had followed Grant to the Civic Center and had called his father to say he was suspicious. And then a taxi blew up in front of City Hall. Micah thinks his son was killed in the blast." Joe and I turned back to the TV and watched as new images came on. It appeared that the roads had been torn up, a few vehicles had been overturned, and City Hall had taken some damage, not yet assessed. But the many iconic buildings were still standing. The body count wasn't in yet, but when Joe picked up his phone to access the Twitterverse, he told me that it was confirmed. The passenger in the cab was dead. I tried not to show Julie that I was shaken when I put her to bed. Had Carrie Woodhouse foiled Grant's plan? Or was Grant's entire escapade meant to end in a suicide car bomb? Connor Grant. Still a mystery to the final freaking kaboom. Chapter 97. While I quelled the fierce bedtime protests from our Bambina, Joe took Martha for a walk. When he came back through the door, I realized I didn't have to say anything about date nights anymore. I disabled the ringers on all the phones. Joe took me into his arms. We went to bed. I was full of so many feelings. That Connor Grant was no longer in our lives. That we were safe. That Joe was home. Joe was home. Joe and I held each other for a good long time before kisses turned up the heat and our clothes came off fast. Making love with Joe wasn't the homey tumble of the last time we'd been together so long ago, and it wasn't the desperate passion we'd felt when our story first began. This was both making love with my husband and the release of the anger and resentment I'd harbored for so long. I told him I loved him. And he told me he loved me so much.
"I'll never let you down again," he said. "I'll never let you go."
We spent the rest of the night talking like we used to do. We never slept, and we heard Julie calling out for me as the sky began to lighten. I went into her room and grabbed her up over the fences and carried her into our bedroom. She crawled in between Joe and me, turned her head to look at each of us.
Nice,
she said. Isn't it? I said, grinning at our adorable, blue-eyed, curly-haired child. It was better than nice. This